Well, look, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the opportunity to be back here. And some of you I know, they're old friends that I've been able to catch up with very briefly. Can I say at the outset, I'm horrified in a way now that I've seen the promotional literature because it's got a picture of me. That's a fairly old picture, by the way. I thought I'd admit that before someone asked. I was in Indonesia. I was asked to talk to a church in Jakarta a little while ago. And I was a bit amazed when I got there. It had a congregation of 6,000 who met over three services every Sunday and the biggest plasma screen in the southern hemisphere. I mean, this thing was massive, absolutely huge. And it had that very picture up there, you know, sort of me about 10 foot tall. And a very nice Indonesian man with a slightly evil glint in his eye looked at me, looked at the photograph, looked back at me and said, "How long ago was this photo taken?" That was the least of my worries. The worst of it was that, people know about promotion in many places, not just the advertising industry in the West. They were selling me furiously, and they had, in quite small writing beside my picture, "We welcome," and then in massive writing, "John Anderson," in quite small writing, so you had to look to see it, "former deputy," and then in very big writing indeed, "Prime Minister of Australia." And my initial reaction was, wow. And then I thought, I hope there's nobody around here who doesn't like Australians or people of faith. Anyway, I saw yours and I thought, there's a picture of me with inspiring leadership. Well, you know, that pride problem, I would hate anyone here to think that I think I'm an inspiring leader. I'm sure I'm not. Every time I think that perhaps I am, I remember back to campaigning in the 1993 election. Some of you will remember it. That's probably a long time ago for some of the younger amongst you. But I was in the little town of Wellington, which is in the middle of New South Wales, and it was in my electorate. And we'd done it. We were doing it the old-fashioned way. I was launching my campaign off the back of a truck with some hay bales and what have you, and trying to get a bit of a debate going with the people in the audience, not having much luck, and in despair after I'd said everything I could think of to say and how wonderful we'd be if you voted for us and what have you, I went over to the bank, and it was in the days before ATMs in country towns, and so I wrote out a cheque. It was Friday afternoon, and I needed to have some cash for the following day. And the very nice young man behind the counter, who plainly recognised me, smiled, said, "This will be all right, but, you know, you understand the procedure. I have to have it cleared by a second officer." And he went down the back. I couldn't hear what he said, but he'd obviously said something that the very attractive young lady down there associated with the need to tell everyone what she thought about politicians. And she had a voice that carried. "Ah, politicians," she said. "I've got a vote for the first time coming on Saturday." She said, "My dad said not to vote, it only encourages them, and you end up with more of them." And she said, "I wouldn't feed them," as though she personally knew quite a few. Well, she came back down with a check, you see, and all the corporate training re-exerted itself. And she smiled beautifully. She had the nameplate on, said, "Is there a Mr. Anderson here?" And I said, "Yes, that's me." She said, "I can cash your check for you, sir." So I go over, and as she's cashing it, I can't help it. I thought, I've got to follow through on this somehow. I said, "Well, you know, Angela, I'm sure you'd like me to believe that some banks are better than others, because many of us think the banks are terrible, but some banks would be all right." "Oh, yes, sir, of course," she said. "The National Australia..." Oh, I shouldn't have let that out. "But it's a wonderful bank." But she said, "That's a funny thing to say." I said, "It's just that, you know, you think some banks are better than others. I'd like you to believe that not all politicians are terrible and some of them are better than others." And she looked at me really puzzled, as if to say, "Where's this bloke come from?" And I said, "My name's John Anderson. I've just heard you sort of say that you don't like politicians, you don't want to feed them because that encourages them and, you know, all the rest of it. I'm the member for Gwydir and I'd like your vote next Saturday." Well, this sort of look of dawning horror spread across her face. And then sometimes when you've got yourself in, you know, you dig yourself in even deeper to the immense amusement of the people gathered around then by then sort of watching this interchange, she blurted out, "Oh," she said, please, "you mustn't take it personally. I didn't mean the little ones like you, I meant the big ones like Paul Keating and John Hewson." So you see, when you represent a rural electorate, they keep you in your place. Because one of the things I want to say to you today is that we live in a world... Now, I am incredibly thankful that I was born an Australian. It's not my choice. I can't claim responsibility for it. but by the grace of God, I was born an Australian. I mean, I can't think of a country I'd rather be born into, or a society I would rather have grown up in, or lived out my life in, introduced my children to. I just think we are so, so fortunate. But I also want to say to you that I am very, very, very concerned about where the West is going. Australia is part of the West. We're not in the West. We're in Asia, as it happens, but we're part of the West. And I think it is a very, very serious problem indeed. I think we're staggering around not knowing who we are or where we've come from. We're like the two Australian soldiers that go to the pub in England after a long trip on a ship, and they stagger out. They're pushed out at 10 o'clock at closing time onto the street, and Jimmy says to Billy, "Hey, Jimmy, we've got a problem now. We don't know where we are. We don't know where the ship is. We're lost." And Billy says, "Oh, well, that's all right. We'll ask this fella coming down the street. You know, it's the Admiral of the British Fleet, and he's covered in, you know, scrambled egg, yellow gold braid and all the rest of it, and very tall and aristocratic looking." They pull him up, say, "Oh, we're lost. Can you tell us where we are?" To which this fellow, you know, as only the Brits can do, pulls himself up to his full height and says, "My good man," he said, "the question is not where you are. The question is, do you know who I am?" And Jimmy looks at Billy and says, "No, we're in real trouble. We don't know where we are, and he doesn't know who he is." You know, that's about where we've got to in Western society. And people are crying out for leadership. And I'll tell you up front what I think we need to first recognize about leadership, and it's a great irony, and it goes to the heart of the problem for us in our societies. The complaint you always hear about our leaders is that they seem to be more interested in looking after themselves than in us. That's at the genesis of the number one complaint you get about politicians today, isn't it? When you analyze it out, we think they're about them and their interests and not us. Now, I'm not one of them anymore. Can I tell you, we're being a bunch of hypocrites. Because what are we all about? Us. We have radically turned the Christian worldview that made Western society what it is, free, prosperous, places where people want to live. We have turned the worldview that built those societies on its head. The Chinese, interestingly, in Beijing, in trying to understand the West, have invested huge resources in trying to establish what's going on, how the West succeeded. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who until recently was the chief rabbi in the House of Lords in England, referred to this in a very eloquent speech. I recommend it to you. I can't think what the speech is called, but if you look up Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, you'll find it. And he talks about the influence of the Judeo-Christian belief system on the West. And he says of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, charged with the job of understanding the West, that they first, when they reported back, they said, "Firstly, we thought it was your weaponry, your guns." That's an irony, because the Chinese invented gunpowder, and they were saying that, well, it took the West to learn how to turn it into weapons of destruction. But they said, "No, you didn't realize then that it wasn't that. We thought then that perhaps it was capitalism. Capitalism was at the heart of Western success. Then we thought, no, there's more to it than that. It must be their political system, democracy, the rule of law, and so forth. But no, we now understand it was Christianity. It was Christianity." And to build on that, the ABC Religion Hour. There you go. Did you know the ABC had a Religion Hour? Just to show that I sometimes listen to the ABC. Well, I didn't. I got a transcript of it, actually. But they carried a fascinating report recently where, covering a major study undertaken by the Chinese authorities into the state of the church in China. Now, this must be true. It was on the ABC. And the report came back saying, you know, 70, 80, 90 million Chinese are now Christian. I mean, most people think it's actually way in excess of that. It's an extraordinary thing. Bad news for the modern atheists in the West. China is Christianizing at an extraordinary rate, both at home and amongst the expats around the world. But the intrepid reporter asked the Beijing correspondent why this was of concern to the Chinese government. You know the answer? Because the Chinese authorities understand that Christianity gives rise for agitation for democracy. Really? What does that mean? Well, democracy is based in the idea, you see, that every individual matters. No matter how weak, no matter how poor, no matter what gender, what colour, what sex, whatever, every individual bears the stamp of God. The rule of law is based in that principle. The king should matter, respect the little person, just as the big person has to, little person has to respect the king. These are absolutely radical ideas. You know, I hear people say Christianity is conservative and reactionary and old hat and stuffy. It's the most radical doctrine that's ever hit mankind. And when it transforms enough lives in any given society, it transforms the societies. And that's a very, very shorthand version. And, you know, history shows it was tumultuous and there were many ups and many setbacks and so on and so forth. But the reality is that it was that worldview that shaped the West, gave rise to the rule of law, based on the idea that every individual matters, but also gave us the vote. As one American put it, we're so good we had to give ourselves a vote, we're so bad we had to give ourselves the vote. The idea that your neighbour matters, love your neighbour as yourself. We actually want our politicians and our leaders to live by that creed. But do we as a society? No, we don't. We've turned our predominant Western worldview on its head. You can see it in the advertising industry. There's a bank, not the one I mentioned earlier so clumsily, that captured it beautifully a few years ago. They had a hand pointing out of a page, and the block headlines, look after the most important person in the world. Your wife? Your child? Your neighbour in need? The constituent? No, you. Now, Canberra, that city of 300,000 surrounded by reality over on the other side of the country. I was there the other day. I don't go there very often now, but I was, and I was watching the news, and it was interrupted by ads. They come around with monotonous regularity. And there was an ad there that had the two sayings you see often in ads, both rolled into one. Buy this village home because you deserve it. It's all about you. As if you have raised children, will know, if you stop and think about it, you don't actually have to teach them to consider themselves as the most important person in the world, do they? I mean, essentially, it's at the core of our nature. We grow up, if it's not corrected in us, thinking that we are the centre of the universe and the sun goes around us. It's not the creed that our society was built on. We've abandoned it. Does it matter? Well, yes, we're crying out for leadership. Why are we crying out for leadership? Because our society is in an absolute mess. One of the grimmest days in my public life was the 11th of March, 1996. Should have been a great day. We were sworn in. I was 39. There were three of us in that government that were under 40, Peter Costello and Mike Wooldridge and me. And, you know, to be sworn in as a senior minister of the Crown and a cabinet minister and a deputy leader of a political party at that age, I mean, that was pretty heady stuff. And, you know, I'm sure, me being human, I mean, I deny all memory of it now, but I'm sure there were moments then when I thought I was pretty clever. And that was soon to be, any cockiness was soon to be smashed out of me, because when we got into the cabinet room for the first time, which is essentially a very nicely decorated concrete box in the bowels of the Parliament House in Canberra, surrounded with, lined with gould prints. The old timers might remember the controversy over Paul Keating buying gould prints. When I got in there, I could see why he tried to do something with it, I tell you. Because I was to spend so much of my life there after that I got sick of the sight of those walls. But the Prime Minister looked very grim, though we'd just been sworn in. I knew how much he'd wanted to be sworn in as Prime Minister. I thought, why is he looking so grim? And he said, look, he said, we've had a proper briefing this morning, Peter Costello and I, on the real state of the nation's finances. It's very serious. He said, and I want you to remember these words, he said, we're going to have to do something. It's so serious, or we're going to be engaging otherwise in intergenerational theft. We're running up so much public sector debt, it's going to come against our kids and our grandchildren. There's a good term, isn't it? Intergenerational theft. Can I say, he didn't say, but can I say to you, a society that where people love their neighbours will not cripple their children and their grandchildren. I'll come to that in a moment. So we started the business then of And he said, Peter Costello, treasurer and the finance minister and the assistant treasurer will set up a budget process, and it will be joined by Mike Wooldridge, who'll do the spending portfolios, as they're called. John Anderson, you'll do the economic portfolios. And it was the most grinding work I've ever been engaged in, but it gave me a real insight into what happens when a society loses control of its finances. Because this is one of the major things that's happened to the West. A very interesting article by an American called Daniel Altman. You can find it in Newsweek, 2011. The United States of Narcissism. And he says, America today, and let's not pick on the Americans. He could have picked any country in the West. America today looks less like the United States of America, with people pulling together, and more like the United States of Narcissism. Now, this is not a Christian writer. This is a secular writer, a very, very bright one. But he picks up the three essential problems in the West. And the first problem he picks up is, he says, this obsession with self. Narcissus, you may remember, was the young Greek, very handsome young man, who bent over a still pool of water for a drink and fell hopelessly in love with the most beautiful person he'd ever encountered, to the exclusion of effective relationships with other people. He fell in love with himself. And that's Altman's thesis. And he says, this thesis since the 1960s, when we stopped thinking about our neighbour, when we stopped trying to put together ideas on how to build a better society, in a journey of self-discovery and free love, we actually came to the conclusion that it was all about me. All about me gratifying myself. Eat, drink, be merry. There's no tomorrow. It's all too hard thinking about that big stuff. And in an age of cheap credit, people started to rack up extraordinary personal debts. And when they couldn't do it anymore, they passed it on to governments. And guess what? By the culture of the age, in many countries, by the grace of God, we're not one of them. We're one of the very few Western countries where all the trend lines are wrong, but we're not yet in crisis. I want to say that to you. What happened was that people started to insist on weak-kneed politicians. You give me more and I'll vote for you. And the politicians, knowing they can put it on tick and there's no immediate pain, and that someone down the future, some future generation will have to worry about it, and some future politicians will have to clean up the mess, have given way. And given way. And given way and given way. A very stark example of this, of course, is provided by Greece, where their, for those of you who are interested in it, when they still had a GDP, their public sector debt was 161% of GDP. In other words, the taxpayer debt, so it's not corporate, it's not private, it's just the taxpayer debt, the government debt, was 161% of the total value of all the goods and services produced in Greece that year. And that's a truly horrifying figure. And you're getting into uncharted country. But if the debt's that much at 161%, guess what happens in the future? The politicians have promised so much more to the voters who have needed so much more in the future that the debt goes like that. It's not 161%, it's over 1,000%. And the number of taxpayers who are going to foot the bill goes like that. The gap gets wider. It's a full-blown crisis. And even now, before the full-blown crisis has hit in Greece, which is an extreme example, extreme one, but it's a sobering warning. Just think about this for a moment. Children in Greece today go to school starving if their parents are out of work, because there's no welfare system anymore to meet their needs. And 3/4 of young Greeks between the age of leaving school and 30 cannot find work. Now, Greece was a first world country. We thought it never happened to people like us. And Altman is saying this came about because of the abandonment of prudence and the giving over to self-obsession. I said that he identified two other great problems. He goes on in the same article, if you Google it, to say that tomorrow's families will have to do a better job of what? Raising their children to be more other person-centred. See what I said? We've tipped the Christian worldview on its head, and now even the secularists can see that it's our own self-obsession and selfishness that's killing us, and we're going to have to raise our kids. Well, now, which families might he be talking about? Because he's an American, and 45% of American children, by the time they're five, have lost one or other parent out of the home, nearly always the father. If you're a black American, it's 70%. If you're in Britain today, you're more likely to have a television in your bedroom than a father under your roof by the time you're five. In Australia, not quite there yet, but the trend lines aren't healthy. In our worshipping of the diversity of family structures that we now see, we're actually exposing our children to a sea of uncertainty, and often much worse. So in identifying the problem and then pointing to the solution, he's failing to recognize we've so smashed and so trashed so many families that many of them will be in great need. They won't be the people who can help rebuild. They'll be people of great need. And the third thing that he identifies is that in the midst of all of this is this astonishing smugness that refuses to join up the dots and acknowledge that we've got it wrong and we need to go and rethink. And that is the thing that amazes me most, that the people who control the debate in Western society today display this extraordinary arrogance that chief and foremost says, one thing we will not let you do is to reconsider our Christian roots. You want an example of it? In Australia, you might have noticed we've had a vigorous debate in this country about the national curriculum. I don't believe we should have a national curriculum because the wrong people always get control of them. But it's been decided we should have a national curriculum so that we, and the motives originally, by the politicians responsible for it, I think we're probably quite good, was to try and raise the standards to which our children are educated. But the people who've got control of it have decided that the emphasis, the three great themes should be sustainability, which I have to tell you as a farmer often means telling people that farmers ruin land. I've seen some of the teaching material back east. I don't know whether it's the same here, but it's often, our farmers ruin our land. It's Aboriginality, which is sometimes well taught, but I stress sometimes, and it often just results in an ill-informed guilt trip. And I have the utmost respect for Aboriginal people and the need to do everything we can for them. And the third thing that we study is Asia, okay? And that's good. We live in Asia. I support that. But guess what? Guess what? When the government calls a review and one of the review panel says, well, we should actually be teaching our children a little more of their culture because, after all, we have a constitution which guarantees our freedom, and it was written at a time when 90% of the population said they believed in Christianity, surely our children would do well to understand their own roots. And there were two reactions which were very interesting. One was that the ABC said, not everybody agrees, including a lot of people at the ABC, I suspect, and they put up somebody from the Australian Rationalist Society. Did any of you see it? Now, that's the atheists, basically. And she made the most irrational commentary I've ever heard. Oh, she said, that'd be the slippery slope, teaching people about Christianity in our schools. Oh, we can't do that. We've got to keep them secular. But here's the irony. Then an expert on Asia stood up and said, actually, you'll better understand Asia if you understand your own culture. Let me give you one reason for that. Asia is Christianizing. Even Indonesia, there are probably more Christians in Indonesia than there are Australians in Australia. There you go. There's a thought for you. I see someone smiling broadly at that. You go to South Korea, India, 130 million, 140 million believers, church growing rapidly. You go to China, as I said, estimates vary between 1 and 200 million. Some people say by the middle of the century it'll be 500. So we say to our children, we want you to understand Asia. Asia will be a ferment of ideas, of debate about creeds, belief systems. Christianity will feature very largely in it, but oh no, we can't have our children understanding our Christian heritage. They might start to believe it. That's what we've got to. We won't join up the dots. Altman identifies that. Our smugness. We won't go back. Let me then try and pull some of this together. What does it really mean? I want to say to you, I honestly believe that just as we as individuals need again to stop and engage our minds and join up the dots and learn the lesson of our history, which is that when we've turned up, that when we've embraced the Christian God, our freedoms have grown, democracy has flourished. Not always have been setbacks. I don't want to make it sound overly simplistic, but broadly speaking, that's been the trend line. You won't find a serious historian in the world who'll argue that proposition. Not really. We have also seen in our history that when we've tried to escape from God, think socialism, think particularly communism and fascism, the left-wing and the right-wing way of saying we can do it better without God. We've had the blessings of Christian faith that ought to encourage us to believe. We've had the warnings of deserting it. It is time we engaged our minds and joined up the dots again individually and corporately. And what I want to say to you is this: I deeply and profoundly believe that you are right when you say we want our leaders to be concerned with us. They should be there to serve us. You're right. Our instincts are correct. That's what we want. And in fact, that's what the Almighty would demand of them, that they love their neighbours, particularly that they seek to serve those that they've been put there to lead. See, the Christian model of leadership is service. That's what it is. Henry Ford II, he was the grandson of the famous car maker. Don't ask me why it was him. But he was asked once, give me a simple definition, a kid said, of leadership. And he said, leadership is the ability to form a vision, to work out what needs to be done, to see what needs to be done and how to get there, what needs to be done. Secondly, a leader must be able to explain, to articulate to others what the vision is and what needs to be done to get there. Thirdly, you need the personal qualities to encourage people to go with you and make that vision a reality. Now, that's not a bad little template. If you're in a leadership position, you might like to think about that. You need a vision. You've got to articulate it. You've got to inspire others to work with you to achieve it. But it's not enough, is it? I can think of several historical horrors who were very good at all three. Think the Nuremberg rallies. Now, there was a vision. The supreme race. And he certainly articulated it well enough to the people. They understood enough of it to work with him to make it happen. It's about the vision, isn't it? See, that man's vision was essentially an atheistic one that said, let's speed up the process of evolution. Only the fittest should survive, and I'll determine who the fittest are. The Aryan race, until they started losing the war, and Hitler decided that they were losing the war and he'd throw everything at it to cost even more German lives because plainly they weren't the top of the pecking order. He decided that. Great leader. At the other extreme, you have the Christ-like vision. We see Jesus laying down his life, utterly innocent, totally betrayed. The most evil thing ever perpetrated by human beings against another human being, yet used for the extraordinary good, I believe, of extricating us from our alienation from God and offering us a chance to be restored. What I want to say out of that is this. In a lifetime now, and I am grey for a good reason, I'm approaching 60, 57 or whatever I am, of watching all of this stuff, watching people, watching creeds, watching governmental systems, I am a profound believer in the transformational power of Christianity, building more civilized societies, points back to the truth of what people believe when their lives are transformed. I also believe that the only thing that equips us, now here's a challenging remark for you, to love our enemies is in fact the gospel. And I think it works this way. The two great commandments, Jesus said, are love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And the second is like it, love your neighbour. I believe we can only love our neighbour when we love God, and we can only love God when we actually understand what has been done for us on the cross. See the feedback through politics? When we know what's been done for us, we can love God, we can obey the command to love others, because it's very hard. I've met a lot of people. I don't know that I've ever met anyone yet who's capable really of loving their enemies, except those who have been truly convinced of the truth of Christ who died for his enemies. that they might be reconciled. Now, those are very provocative statements for those of you who have not heard them or don't believe them. I know that. There'll be people here who want to throw that back in my face. But I want to challenge you. Join up the dots. Ask yourself what sort of world we are now creating. Ask yourself whether we don't need to love our neighbours, because most of the West, you see, has destroyed its children. I mean, I think our children are the responsibility of us and our leaders. The intergenerational theft that has been engaged in by most Western countries, the wealthiest, most satiated societies the world has ever seen, still not able to live within their means, leave their children crippling debts. It's just a very potent example of the broader problem that we're unable to break away from the essential problem that lies at the heart of the conundrum of good and evil, and that is our own selfishness. I believe it can only be broken, only by the power of Christ. If you have a different view, I'd love to hear it. I close by saying the one thing I miss from politics is a good stoush. Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to take some questions.